Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Roger Hart, Chief Executive Officer and past Vice Chair CFO of IFIP IP3. Roger is a leading international thought leader. Roger, you have an amazing career, a very successful one, let's say going back over 40 years, with considerable international success and recognition, and you're acknowledged as a leader in professionalism and in the IT profession itself and in various segments of the IT field or computing field. So I thank you for coming in today to talk to our audience and share your experiences and all of the wisdom that you've accumulated over all these years. Roger, you were recently invited to the Global CIO Forum held in Shanghai. Can you tell us about the goal of this forum?
Yes, I can, Stephen. I think there were two goals. One was the explicit one, and the other was a little more covert, but still definitely on the table. The main goal was to invite some very high-profile European CIOs, the CIO of Alcatel, Air France, KLM, Lufthansa, and so forth, were all there. And what the Chinese wanted to do was to promote China as a viable partner in offshore outsourcing. Some of these companies, for example, Alcatel already had well-established outsourcing partnerships with the Chinese. Others even had offices in Shanghai. Many, if not all of them, had outsourcing arrangements with companies in India, so they were familiar with offshore outsourcing. And, you know, the Chinese wanted to put their best foot forward and say, if you're considering outsourcing, these are our advantages compared to other offshore locations you might want to choose. Then the implicit goal was, you know, just to present China as a real force in IT. And as I said, that wasn't quite as explicit as the outsourcing goal, but it's one that I think all of the participants came across saying, wow, you know, we talk about things like cloud computing. The Chinese are actually here and now doing it.
So you're indicating that amongst the attendees then were really senior leaders, I should say, from, you know, some of the largest organizations worldwide. Do you see that kind of sort of participation from the Chinese side as well? You know, and like you had European CIOs there, where there's that kind of participation from the Chinese side?
Yes, of course. I mean, the Chinese came from different segments. There were senior government leaders from the central ministries in Beijing. There were municipal leaders. There were CEOs, CFOs, CIOs, and a term that I hadn't heard before, CGOs, Chief Global Officer, from some of the leading Chinese IT companies. And I want to say a word about municipalities, if I can, Stephen, because the scale at which they do things in China, even for people like me who have been going to Asia for a lot of years, is just quite mind-blowing. Shanghai, the municipality, has a population of two-thirds of that of the entire population of Canada. It's huge. A small town, 1,000 kilometers west of Shanghai and 1,000 kilometers south of Beijing, called Wuhan, has a university student population of 1 million. I mean, these are numbers that just blow you away when you see them in reality.
Well, that's pretty incredible. A student population of 1 million.
Yeah, in one town.
Right.
And the interesting thing about Wuhan is that it was formerly a heavy industry town. It's located on the banks of the Yangtze, and the Yangtze is navigable by large freighters, even 1,000 kilometers inland, they are deliberately remaking themselves as a high-tech center. They call it Optics City as opposed to Silicon Valley. And, massive infrastructure investment to make sure that happens.
So if you were to kind of summarize, what did you really learn or what kind of lessons did you take away from the CIO Forum in Shanghai?
Oh, good heavens, that's a long question or a question that deserves a long answer. Let me try and summarize it as best I can. Certainly they managed to get taken very seriously by some very senior CIOs of Fortune 500 companies. That was apparent. Secondly, we talk about China being tomorrow. I don't think it is. I think China is here and now. What they are currently doing is incredible. What they will do in the future is just mind-blowing. For example, we had a presentation by the CEO of the state grid. That's the equivalent of a BC Hydro or an Ontario Hydro or a Duke Power, if you want to use an American example. They have 1 billion customers, and they are rolling out smart technology to these billion customers in order to save on electricity. It's another thing that we talk about. It's something that the Chinese are doing. And as I said, when they start to do something, they do it on a colossal scale.
Did you get an opportunity to go to the Shanghai World's Expo?
I did, and that was a little disappointing from my perspective because Shanghai was having a heat wave. It was about 40 degrees Celsius. It was very, very humid. And although it was a fascinating exhibition by about 3 in the afternoon, I was just wilting from the heat and the crowds. And, I had to call it a day, which was very disappointing. So I planned to make an evening trip when the temperature was a little lower. And the evening I chose, we had a torrential downpour, the only one that I had while I was in China. So I'm hoping that I get to see it on my next trip.
Can you then share your experiences or add to your experiences in this discussion today from the CIO Forum, but from a professional business perspective?
Yes, I can. And again, this this demands a long answer, but I would say for me, both from the Chinese side and from the CIO side, it underscored the need for professionalism in IT. Let me talk about the CIOs first of all, because their initial reaction to the goal of IP3, which of course is to promote professionalism in IT on a global basis, their initial reaction was very skeptical. And it was only when I started drawing parallels between other professions, such as accountants, lawyers, engineers, and so forth, that they understood what I was saying. And they began to nod their head in agreement and saying, that is really important. So I think one of the things that IP3 and IFIP have to do is, not only to talk to ourselves, but to reach out and reach out very assertively to organizations with whom we have relationships so that we can start talking about this concept at a senior level. If I talk about the Chinese, one of the things that I wasn't prepared for in China was the number of people, particularly from the U.S., from Hong Kong, and from Taiwan, who have either returned to China or gone to China to take leadership positions in Chinese enterprises. Their English, when they were Chinese, was impeccable. Sometimes they were native white Americans. They had MBAs from places like Harvard. They had impeccable business careers, and you know, here they are in China, spearheading some very exciting IT organizations. And at the other end of the spectrum, the Chinese have a huge talent pool. I mentioned earlier the fact that Wuhan has 1 million university students. Shanghai has 500,000 students every year taking college entrance examinations. So there is no shortage of really excellent talent entering the workforce, and in particular entering the IT workforce. Where the challenge is, I saw this, and I think the Chinese see it as well, is in the middle tier. In other words, not the senior management of the company, but the people who the first tranche of IT professionals that IP3 is aiming after are sitting. We would call that in professionalism jargon the equivalent of SOFIA Level 5. SOFIA is an international framework. It actually is an acronym that stands for the Skills Framework for the Information Age. And when you're at SOFIA Level 5, you have sufficient autonomy to make decisions regarding staffing and budget allocation and decisions about project design and so forth. And that's precisely the area where, in my opinion, the Chinese could benefit from having this huge cadre of IT professionals certified by an IP3 accredited organization, because that would give a stamp of objective international approval on a huge scale, and just give a huge boost of confidence to potential partners of the Chinese.
You know, I saw this message from you saying that I'm at the M on the Bund, and sort of very cryptic. You know, what does that mean? So that it kind of leads to this next question. I mean, can you share your experiences from the CIO forum, but from a personal or hospitality perspective?
Yeah, I'm happy to, Stephen. I mean, we were treated extremely well by the Chinese. They dined us quite handsomely. In fact, coming back to North America, and ordinary food was a little bit of a letdown. But you know, your example of M on the Bund was was appropriate, because that is a very famous restaurant. It was one of the first European restaurants to be opened in Shanghai when they started modernizing the city. By Chinese standards, it's very expensive to us from North America. It's amazingly cheap. I mean, my entire meal, including wine, cost me all of $40 Canadian, so it wasn't a particularly big splurge for me. But I had the misfortune, as you know, of having my laptop die on me while I was in China. And so my only means of communication was my iPhone. And almost everywhere you went, including M on the Bund, the Chinese have free Wi-Fi access. So, you know, I'm sitting down, sipping my wine, waiting for dinner to arrive, and I can log in, check my email, and send somewhat short responses, like I did in the message that you mentioned. And that just happened all the time. There was hardly anywhere in China where I couldn't find free Wi-Fi. So, you know, I could listen to CBC in my hotel room. I could, you know, within the limits of the iPhone, surf the web. And in the absence of my laptop, you know, keep at least almost up to date with my email messages.
So I guess this sort of ties into this next question, and that is, you know, you have sort of Western devices and you're going into Asia, into China, And was it a problem to get into their telecommunications network? And kind of what did you do to do that, you know, to get that kind of access?
No, I mean, it was just there. Some of the places, like the hotels, give you a password so that only guests can use it. In restaurants and coffee bars, it was just wide open and free. One of the things that I normally do when I'm traveling is to buy a local SIM card for my cell phone, because most countries of the world outside of North America don't charge you for airtime for incoming calls. They charge you for outgoing calls. And so getting a local SIM card means that my wife can phone me anytime using regular North American international rates, and it's costing me nothing for airtime. So I went into China Mobile next door to the hotel in Wuhan. My first evening there. Paid, I think it was 30 RMB or about $6 for a Chinese SIM card, which came with about half an hour or maybe an hour of local talk time on it. In China, when you buy a SIM card, the whole of China is considered a local dial-in rate, and that was it.
That's quite remarkable. All of China, it's a very large country.
It's a huge country. And I mean, the other thing, and maybe it had little to do with me being Canadian or Westerner or whatever you want to say, was that the level of service that I got from China Mobile compared to, the telcos here in Canada was just amazing. I'm used to going into a cell phone outlet, both in Canada and the U.S. They're in retail establishments. I don't know whether the people who are working there get minimum wage, but, the attitude isn't the greatest. Whereas in China, the level of service, even for people who were struggling a little bit in English, was just amazing.
Can you sort of provide a description then of the cities that you visited? And you were also able to use some of the internal airlines in China. What was that experience like? And also the experience in the hotel itself.
Well, let me answer your question in a couple of ways. First of all, we flew on China Eastern Airlines, and the quality of service, both at the airport and in flight, was up amongst the best that we experienced in North America and Europe. It was friendly service. They actually gave us meals on the plane, which is getting to be a rarity these days. The airports are clean and modern, despite the huge volume of traffic. Security, while being very, very thorough, was much more efficient than I've seen it handled either at Canadian or U.S. airports. Cities, let me just take a break if I can, Steve, and have myself a sip of coffee here because my voice is getting a little hoarse. Just bear with me a second. We were in three cities, Shanghai, Wuhan, and Beijing. Shanghai is just amazing. I mean, they have restored the old concession architecture, so it has a Asian-European feel to part of the cities, but at the same time, they're building this massive, wonderful new complex in Pudong, which has the second highest skyscraper in the world, and it's just an amazing city. And what you don't see in Shanghai that you see in lots of other places in Asia, such as in Manila or Bangkok or even Hong Kong, is squalor surrounding this new building. I'm sure there are areas of squalor in Shanghai, but I traveled extensively throughout the the city, and the city, of course, covers 6,000 square kilometers, so it's a fair-sized city. But while I saw obviously poor areas, I didn't see the grinding squalor that you see in places like Manila. Wuhan is still making a transition, as I said. It used to be a heavy industrial city. It's transforming itself into a major high-tech player. So in Wuhan, more than Shanghai, you saw the little hole-in-the-wall stores, much as you'd see them elsewhere in Asia. Open to the street and with a garage door to close down and keep them secure at night. Whereas in Shanghai, the same sort of stores, at least in the central areas, have been transformed into very chic, modern facades. And, of course, Beijing is Beijing, very, very big, very, very impressive. And we were housed out by the Olympic stadium. So, one thing that television doesn't do is to convey the immensity of the Bird's Nest Stadium and the wonderful architecture and incredible engineering that it took to put that thing together. And to close off, the hotels that we stayed at were five-star. Most of them were as good, and the ones that weren't as good were much better than equivalent hotels that I've stayed at in North America and Europe, and the level of service was just incredible as well.
I guess that sort of brings up another question then. I'm thinking about transportation, getting from one location to another within a city. What was that like?
It was interesting. Remember that we were, important guests, and so we were shuttled about in luxury buses most of the time. Again, unlike most of my experience in Asia, the Chinese have invested massively in infrastructure. So, freeways everywhere, and freeways that have got a lot of greenery and trees deliberately planted alongside them as part of the Chinese efforts to be green with things they do. Flowers everywhere are on the main freeways, even the, I don't know the word from them, but the concrete things in the middle of the road that stop you going from one side of the freeway to another had flowers hanging out of the top of them. Shanghai, I got to travel on the metro by myself. That was incredibly clean, wonderfully air-conditioned given the heat, and very fast and very reliable. And interestingly enough, my daughter was in Shanghai, I think it was 3 years ago. They had four subway lines at the time. They now have 13, and they have another three planned this year. They've also got an extensive network of buses. I read in the book that they have 1,000 bus lines in Shanghai. So again, the scale of things is just a little mind-blowing from people from a country of 30 million. But one of the neatest things that I saw, even though they do have trolley buses, were electric battery-powered buses. And what they do is to raise like an antenna on the roof when they stop at a bus stop to let people on and off, and this presumably charges up the battery and allows it to go at least as far as the next bus stop when it gets another quick boost of charge. And very, very clean, very simple idea, but one that I haven't seen before outside of China.
In terms of communication, I know you have maybe some Mandarin, but how were you able to sort of make your way with English?
I really don't have any Mandarin, Stephen. Thank you for the undeserved compliment. In Shanghai, young people spoke an incredible English. And when I say young people, I mean young people in stores, in hotels, in restaurants, and so forth. So there was no problem there. In the streets, and particularly with the older people, it was harder to speak English. But one of the things that I haven't mentioned when you asked me about transportation were taxis. Didn't use them extensively because, as I said, we were either taken around on buses or I used the metro. But when I did use the taxis, they were clean, air-conditioned, cheap, and no attempt as there would be in Manila or Bangkok to raise the meter by honking excessively or add in a few more clicks here and there when I wasn't looking. And by and large, the taxi drivers do not speak English, so you either need a card for the destination written in Chinese, or there is a really neat application for the iPhone called Shanghai Taxi, which allows you to type in a destination in English and comes up with the Chinese of it on your screen. So you can simply pass that over to your cab driver and say, take me there.
So I then sort of come to this idea that you would recommend attendance at future forums in China?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And this one was largely for the Europeans. As I said, some of the companies represented, like Alcatel-Lucent, already had outside sourcing arrangements with China. So, when you're inviting foreign guests, it's always nice to have people who know you and respect you on the trip so that they can give you praises in front of their colleagues. A lot of the Chinese firms that we visited had offices in North America. Interestingly enough, most of them down in the Seattle area. So I think there's a huge opportunity that we're missing in Canada, that we don't encourage them to set up in Vancouver or even Victoria. But as I said, a lot of them have offices in Seattle, in San Francisco, and would, I'm sure, welcome guests from North America.
What are your predictions for China?
Well, I went to China thinking that I was well informed about China. I have been to Asia lots of times. I've been to Taiwan. I've been to Hong Kong. My daughter has spent 2 years working in China. I was totally unprepared for what I saw. China describes itself as a developing country, and I guess it technically is. But in the whole area of IT, they are doing things today that just make my head spin, and make it spin in a good way. So I think they will become a powerhouse in IT in exactly the same way as they have in manufacturing. And I think it will happen far sooner than anybody's predictions. As I said, the scale at which they do things, the speed with which they're able to make decisions is just impressive. And, having worked in business for the last, 20 years or so, after I quit being a university professor, I learned that you have to get everything right all the time, that if you can make a decision based on an 80% probability of being right, that then most of the time you're in good shape. And the Chinese seem to do that routinely. So, I did a lot of background reading on my trip, a lot of books that were published in the early days of the 21st century predicted a collapse of the Chinese economic system and the bursting of the bubble and those sorts of things. Those have been proven manifestly incorrect. And as I said, I think China is a powerhouse in manufacturing, and it won't be very long at all before they become the equivalent powerhouse in IT. So as far as IP3 is concerned, unless we can get a foothold in China in the near future, I think we're going to miss a huge, huge and very exciting opportunity.
So, we've spent quite a bit of time talking about China and your experiences there, and I can hear the awe and sort of the wow factor that you experienced in your trip. And also it was by invitation, which is sort of an acknowledgement of your standing, and your reputation. So, again, sort of, I think, kudos to you and to the IP3 organization for being represented. So now let's kind of move on to Roger Hart and sort of your profile, your past roles and responsibilities, and what kind of lessons you've learned from those past roles.
Oh, you may have given me pause for thought, Stephen, because as you said, I've done a lot of things in the last 40 years. I started out in IT when people literally didn't know what a computer was. I spent something like 10 years as a university professor, give or take another 10 years as a senior college administrator, and then for most of the last 14 years, I worked with Deloitte & Touche, ending up as an associate partner there. So I got involved in IP3 almost by accident. I had been doing some voluntary work for KIPPS, which is the Canadian Association of IT Professionals. And as you know, there was a meeting of the large IFIP societies in Vancouver in 2006. I was invited to attend it, but I had other commitments at the time, so wasn't able to. And out of that came the establishment of what, if I remember at the time, was called the IFIP Task Force on Professional Practice, which subsequently became IP3. And they held their first meeting in Cape Town in January 2007, and KIPPS wanted me to go and attend. And between you and me, I really didn't want to go because I have spent most of the last 20 years doing an awful lot of international flying. When I was with Deloitte, I had top-tier elite status on at least two international carriers and enough air miles to get me and my family seats to anywhere in the world. And Cape Town from Victoria is a long, long, long way. But my colleagues persuaded me that I should go and represent Canada there, and I did, and I was very glad I went because I found that the people I was meeting with from the UK, from Australia, from South Africa, from Europe, and from the US had very, very similar ideas for professionalism in IT that I had. And we started the ball rolling in Cape Town, and even though we've met the occasional bump in the ground, I think, the fact that we've only been going for 3 years, I think of what we've accomplished, I think it's quite astounding.
So you took on the position as vice chair and chief financial officer for this project, this international professional practice program for the International Federation for Information Processing, which is IFIP, which is a UNESCO consultative body. Can you sort of describe what your current roles and responsibilities are right now and sort of the kind of lessons you are learning at this moment?
Well, my current role is the CEO of the organization, and I'm doing that on a part-time basis. They're not paying me to work full-time, although sometimes I feel like I am, even though they're not paying me to do it. It's interesting. I mean, one of the things that we did at Deloitte that is helping is that we worked on a global basis, and we would have conference calls, you know, some of which would be as early as 4 or 5 in the morning, others which would be as late as 12 or 1 in the at the other end of the morning, at the late night end of the morning. And you get used to working like this, so transitioning to work with a board that is scattered throughout the world. I mean, we have board members from New Zealand, from Japan, from Australia, from South Africa, and from Europe and North America. You know, the lessons that I learned from Deloitte are very, very useful in making that happen on a day-to-day basis. The difference is that, you know, a lot of the people that I'm working with on IP3 are volunteers, so you don't get the same level of commitment, and you shouldn't expect the same level of commitment as you would from a partner in a, you know, worldwide consulting firm. So that's a little bit of difference, and I guess that even though we've made you know, huge progress in 3 years, if we had had a team of full-time employees, our progress would have been even faster. But we're not there yet. So you know, we do what we can. We've already got 2 countries, Australia and Canada, having their IT Professional Society accredited. We have Japan, New Zealand, and South Africa coming up very quickly. And as I said earlier in the conversation, you know, we really have to make inroads and do it very soon in countries like China and India, because they are already major players in IT, and they're going to become even bigger. So one of the things that I'm hoping will help, one of the things that I thank you for your help in establishing, Stephen, is the IP3 Global Industry Council. We've established an initial board of directors for that of 9 very, very eminent people, come from, you know, organizations in countries like China and India, as well as the U.S. and Canada. We're aware that we've got holes. Our representation of women, for example, is fairly small at the moment. We need to get more representatives from Australia, Africa, and Europe. But having said that, you know, I think we've got 9 people who are very, very well respected, and you know, using their counsel and advice, I think we'll rapidly build out to a bigger and very dynamic organization.
You know, I guess we can sort of expand further on this IP3 Global Industry Council, in that you're indicating that, you know, the founding directors represent some major organizations, and these organizations are global in scope, though they're headquartered out of North America. Really, they represent every region of the world.
I think that's correct, Stephen, yes.
Okay, so Roger, let's continue on this sort of discussion in the IP3 Global Industry Council, and you are a founding director for this industry council, in fact, a visionary behind it. What do you see then as the purpose of the council, and what do you hope to achieve with this Global Industry Council?
Well, I think I'd answer that in 2 parts, Stephen. I mean, first of all, the purpose of the council is to give advice from senior industry leaders in a number of leading global IT firms to the board of IP3. And I think that's important because, as I said earlier, the board of IP3 is a volunteer board. I think they make some very wise decisions. Sometimes it takes a little longer for them to reach those decisions than I would like, but that's the result of having worked in industry for the last 20 years. I think having our counterparts from industry validate those decisions and provide counsel and help us to reach out to our various stakeholders, which include not only the IT firms, but also major IT employees, governments, and of course the practitioners themselves, will be very useful. But my other hope is that the Global Industry Council will become useful as a forum for its members in their own right. And I'm basing that on the experiences that we had with Deloitte when we helped create a similar body of CIOs in one of the major cities in California. The initial rationale for that, and I'll be blunt, was simply to build relationships with CIOs who were already our clients. But it morphed, and it morphed into an organization where the CIOs continued to meet on a monthly basis because it was the only opportunity they had to talk to their counterparts in other organizations, often in other industries. And they found that they had a lot of common interests that were independent of the industry that they were in. So a hope and an aspiration of mine is that, by bringing these senior people together in the Global Industry Council, not only will they give the board of IP3 the benefit of their advice, but they will create a forum where meeting amongst themselves is seen as useful and desirable, because there are, in reality, very few forums around the world that allow that to happen.
And, there are the benefits that there is a sort of UNESCO affiliation. And what do you think about that?
I mean, having the UNESCO affiliation gives a stamp of international approval to the organization that I think is important. But if I reflect on your question, I would say that up until this point, UNESCO has not been prominent in the workings of IP3, and that's probably something that we should change. I think UNESCO needs to become more aware of what we're doing and the importance of what we're doing, and I think conversely, we need to underscore our relationship with UNESCO more than we have been doing. Now, it's interesting that IFIP, which is the International Federation for Information Processing, the umbrella of IP3, has a new president who will take office after the World Computer Congress in Brisbane. And I think he shares similar views about the importance of UNESCO to the ones that I've just outlined. So maybe there's an opportunity for partnership there. As IP3 is having a face-to-face meeting in parallel with WCC in Brisbane. So, I'm hoping that you and I and other thought leaders can have one-on-ones with the incoming president and maybe make this sort of idea something that's going to happen late 2010 or sometimes 2011.
So perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Roger, but maybe we should maybe define some of these organizations again. And that is, IFIP is the International Federation for Information Processing, a UN-founded body, 50 years old, but it's also an official UNESCO consultative body.
Yes.
IP3 is the International Professional Practice Partnership Program, which is a board and initiative of the IFIP group, this UNESCO consultative body. And then, of course, you have UNESCO, which is the United Nations Education, Scientific, Cultural Organization, which has many initiatives and many consultative groups affiliated with them. And then we have the World Computing Congress, or WCC, which you mentioned, which is almost like the Olympics of the computing field and is held every 2 years, and this year in September in Australia. Does that sort of provide sort of a summary of those kind of acronyms that we've been putting out?
That's a good summary, Stephen. The only thing that I would mention is that UNESCO, of course, is a branch of the United Nations. While the UN is headquartered in New York, UNESCO is headquartered in Paris. As you say, it has many initiatives, many consultative bodies, but to be a formal consultative body as IFIP is very important and gives not only a major stamp of international approval, but it gives us a relationship that we need to leverage more to other international NGOs such as the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and the International Telecommunication Union and the Asia Development Bank, and the list goes on. And as IP3 starts to mature, I think we've got to reach out more to these international NGOs as part of our overall communication and goal of building professionalism in IT.
Now, you indicated that IP3 is going to be at the World Computing Congress, or WCC, in September in Australia. Can you sort of define or outline what the goals of IP3 will be at the WCC?
Yes, I can. When IP3 was a task force, it met face-to-face twice a year and, frankly, didn't do an awful lot in between the meetings. I mean, it didn't wither and die, but the main focus of activity were those face-to-face meetings. When it formally became a board of IFIP, which happened at the General Assembly in Hanoi, Vietnam, last the end of August of 2009, we made the decision that it was just too expensive to fly people all around the world for face-to-face meetings. And so we've been trying to hold monthly meetings by conference call, which is much more cost-effective and I think productive. But again, my experience with Deloitte, where we did this fairly extensively, is that occasionally a face-to-face meeting allows you to do things that are a little more intractable to do by conference call. So we're having a face-to-face board meeting in parallel with WCC. We're also having a face-to-face AGM, which IFIP requires us to have, so it makes sense to do those two things at the same time. There is another group that I don't want to get into in this interview called the Seoul Accord Group, so we will be meeting with them in Brisbane. And we're also putting on an IP3 day as part of the World Computer Congress in order to do some promotion of IP3 to both the IFIP society members and to Australian IT businesses. So we've got a fairly ambitious and comprehensive program for IP3 in Brisbane.
And IFIP itself, this International Federation for Information Processing, can you describe that group, the affiliates, the member bodies, and what that means?
Yeah, I'm speaking from memory, Stephen, so I will have this slightly wrong. As you said, it's an organization that is 50 years old, and it was founded by national IT societies when we used to call IT information processing, which is why the IFIP acronym is IFIP rather than IFIT, but there you go, things change in 50 years. There are some 50-odd members, full members of IFIP, and a handful of affiliate members. But it's important to remember that some of the full members and some of the affiliate members are also groups of countries. So, for example, the Asia-Pacific, the Latin America, and the European equivalents to IFIP have national members. Now, some of those national members may be members of IFIP, and sometimes they're not. So, in total, you know, if you count all of those affiliate membership and membership of other regional bodies, probably close to 100 organizations represented worldwide in IFIP, with something of the order of a million members. And of course, those million members are often senior and experienced IT leadership. So the influence of the IFIP membership goes well beyond those million, and you know, probably a multiplication factor of somewhere between 5 and 10. So a very, very august and important international group.
Now, throughout the latter half of this interview, we've discussed this idea of IT professionalism and IT as a profession. But really, what does that mean? What are the aspects that make you know, IT into a profession?
Well, let me draw on my experience with Deloitte, Stephen. Deloitte, as you know, is primarily an accounting firm, although they have a very successful IT consulting practice. They make an awful lot about their young practitioners getting their CAs. They have big parties every time, you know, a group of junior practitioners achieve a milestone, and have a gala banquet where they actually get their CAs and a very substantial bonus at the same time. You know, at a simplistic level, we ought to be doing that for IT. We ought to recognize people in IT as being an important cornerstone of modern society that demands a level of professionalism. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate, but if you tell a lay person that you work in IT, the image that they conjure up is probably one of, you know, a technician repairing computers in a workshop rather than a CIO in a skyscraper in Shanghai. And I think that the more we focus on professionalism in IT, the more we're able to change that image. And, you know, changing the image is one part of it, making sure that the projects that we do in IT are done with a level of professionalism is even more important, but maybe not as much for the public perception.
So do you see this then tying into things like an established code of ethics, adhering to standards, also having demonstrated continuing professional development?
Well, you know, not only am I an IT professional, I'm also a professional engineer, and we have all of those things that you mentioned in engineering and the other professions. I think it's critical and essential that we have them in IT.
Can you provide your outlook for the future of IT as a profession?
It will happen. I mean, there is just no doubt. IT is just so important to modern society that it has to become professional. Whether or not IP3 succeeds is another question. I hope it will. I think it will. But if it doesn't, then there will be some other initiative that achieves what IP3 is trying to do. It's not a question of if, it's a question of how and when. And I think IP3 has got an awful lot of things going for it, so I think it stands an extremely good chance of being that cornerstone, but if it doesn't, then somebody else will pick it up and make it happen.
Well, you know, Roger, we're at the end of this interview, but I just want to mention to the audience that you have just an amazing sort of background in computing, you know, from being one of the founders of the Global Industry Council currently to, you know, being the chief executive officer of this initiative, being invited to this global CIO forum in Shanghai because of your reputation and working, you know, for Deloitte. Prior to that, being on the national board of the Canadian Information Processing Society, you know, being a university professor, a senior college administrator, being one of the early forecasters of the viability of the internet and the difference it's going to make in the world today, being a founder of some of the key communities that are out there. It just, the list goes on and on. It's just a remarkable career over many, many decades, and you continue to have a significant impact on the world today. And for the audience sake, I know that you're going to be one of the key leaders at the World Computing Congress representing IP3, but you also have a meeting with senior executives upcoming in Redmond with Microsoft, and the list goes on and on. Do you have any closing comments you want to make? Maybe something other than computing?
Closing comments other than computing? Well, it's interesting. We had my grandson staying with us at the moment. He's trying to finish grade 9 over the summer. Asked him what he wants to be, his choice at the moment is between being a astrophysicist and an IT professional. And I think one of our challenges. And it comes back to some of the things that we talked about earlier, is that, you know, astrophysicist, while it's a terribly boring job, because I know a number of astrophysicists, really has a classy name to it, whereas I think we still need to come up with a good name that captures the reality and the essence of IT professionals and don't think we've done it yet, so if any of the audience has some idea there, I'd love to hear from them.
Well, Roger, thank you for that sort of, you know, how would you call it, a challenge to the audience to participate, right, and on this venture of creating this global profession with you, and again, for all of the pioneering work that you have done over many, many, many years. So, you know, you have this extensive history of successes, and we are really fortunate you came in today to do this interview. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Stephen. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Chief Executive Officer and past Vice Chair and Chief Financial Officer of IFIP IP3. Roger is a leading international thought leader with decades of multiple successes.